Full vocabulary.
My parents pay for it, Benji says. They offered it to me and I couldn't say no. I mean, I guess I could have said no, but you'd have to be crazy to turn a place like this down.
Part of Celeste agrees, of course, but another part of her stands in righteous opposition. She thinks of Rocky, who rents a studio apartment in Queens. He rides the NR train into the city at 5 o'clock each morning to run the bodega. At night, he takes classes at Queens College. He's studying to be a teacher. There's nobility in that, Celeste sees. A nobility and an ethic that's missing when one lives in an apartment that could easily cost $7,000 or $8,000 a month, paid for by one's parents. This building has a gym, Benji says, and it has a pool. You can use the pool this summer. You can kiss North Meadow goodbye.
I don't want to kiss North Meadow goodbye, Celeste thinks stubbornly.
But she knows she's being silly.
We should appreciate this place while we can, Benji says. My parents are threatening to buy me a brownstone uptown.
A brownstone uptown, Celeste thinks sardonically. Of course, the next logical step. East 78th Street, she murmurs in spite of herself. When she first moved to Manhattan, before she met Merritt, she used to spend her weekends wandering the Upper East Side, looking in windows, admiring leaded glass transoms and iron fretwork. The block between Park and Lexington on 78th Street had been her very favorite. She used to gaze at the fronts of the homes and wonder just what lucky people lived there. People like Benji.
I'll tell them to look only on East 78th Street, Benji says. Now, let's eat.
Celeste spends all week feeling uneasy about Benji's privilege. She can't exactly claim to be blindsided. She knew it existed. But now that the extent of his wealth and advantage has been fully revealed, her view of him is tinged, ever so slightly, with distaste. But then Benji informs her that on the last Sunday of every month, he volunteers at a homeless shelter in the basement of his parents' church on the Upper East Side. He asks Celeste if she would like to come. It entails serving the guests a hot supper, then making up the cots and staying overnight. Benji would be in a room with the men and Celeste with the women.
It's not everyone's cup of tea, he says.
I'll do it, Celeste says.
At Benji's suggestion, Celeste dresses casually, in sweatpants and a t-shirt. She helps chop vegetables for soup, and during the meal she pours coffee. All of the guests want sugar in their coffee, lots of sugar. The pockets of Celeste's pants bulge with packets. One of the male guests starts calling her Sugar Girl. Benji hears him and says, "Hey there, Malcolm, slow your roll. She's my Sugar Girl." This makes everyone laugh. Benji has an easy rapport with the guests and knows many of them by name. Malcolm, Slick, Henrietta, Anya, Linus. Celeste tries to be respectful, to pretend she's working at a restaurant for paying guests, but she can't help wondering what circumstances life threw at these people that they ended up here. With one stroke of bad luck, she supposes, it could be her, or her parents. After dinner, Celeste makes up 14 cots with sheets and blankets. She doles out one flat pillow per guest. Benji had told her that the guests go to bed early, even though TV is allowed until 10, because being homeless is cold and exhausting. Most of the women lie down right away. Celeste has brought her toiletries in a plastic bag, and she goes to the bathroom to brush her teeth and wash her face. It's kind of like living in the college dorms, but she suspects Benji is right. This isn't for everyone. Celeste can't imagine Merritt here in a million years, and his ex-girlfriend Jules even less so. She feels proud of herself for being a good person, then decides that the pride means she's not so good after all. She kisses Benji chastely in the hallway between the men's dorm and the women's dorm.
"Are you going to be okay?" he asks.
"Yes, of course," she says.
"I wish I could be with you," he says. He kisses her again. Celeste crawls onto her cot. The sheets smell like industrial-strength bleach, and the pillow is no more effective than a cocktail napkin. She stuffs her winter coat under her head. She falls asleep listening to the other women snore. She misses her mother. Merritt sends a text in the middle of the following week. How's everything with the boyfriend? Boyfriend. The term gives Celeste pause, but there's no denying it. Celeste and Benji like each other. They're a couple, doing couple things. They're boyfriend and girlfriend. They're happy. And then Celeste meets Shooter. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 9:30 a.m. Nantucket. Marty Skazerba is the head of security at the Nantucket Memorial Airport. It's a town job and comes with full benefits, which nearly makes up for the ball-breaking stress of his job in the summer. June and July are foggy months. In the early summer on Nantucket, warm, moist air flows over the colder water. The moist air cools to its dew point, and a cloud forms at the water's surface. This is fog. Marty wishes the town had a budget allocation for a program in fog awareness, because cutesy t-shirts and mugs that display the slogan, "Fog Happens," don't seem to be getting the message across. Fog happens. It will happen to you, Mr. Millionaire from Greenwich, Connecticut, and to you, Ms. Billionaire from Silicon Valley. Your flight will be delayed or canceled if the ceiling drops below 200 feet. You will miss your connection and your day's plans, board meeting, daughter's graduation from Duke, rendezvous with your lover at the Hotel Le Meurice in Paris, will have to be canceled. On Saturday, July 7th, Marty sits down at his desk for his hot breakfast from Crosswinds, the excellent airport diner, a perk of the job he has greatly appreciated since his wife of 31 years, Nancy, died, to look over his choices on Match.com. Finding an age-appropriate woman who wants to live year-round on Nantucket has proven to be something of a challenge. Marty has been on 3 dates in the past 6 months, but not one of the women has looked a single thing like her profile picture, which has thrown the integrity of the website into question for Marty. His assistant, Benita, is a 33-year-old single woman, and she keeps telling Marty to use Tinder. "Swipe right," she always says. "Guaranteed action." It has become a joke between them. Marty isn't after action. What he would like is a meaningful relationship, a leading lady for his second act. It's just when he is, for the first time, seriously considering Tinder, could he swipe right just once, that a phone call comes in from the chief of police. They have found a body floating out in Monomoy, and there's a person of interest. The name the chief gives Marty is Shooter Uxley, on the run. Marty writes down the name and a description of the guy. Late 20s, dark hair, wearing Nantucket Reds shorts, blue Oxford shirt, navy blazer, and loafers. "Good looking," the chief says. Marty laughs because this description fits any of 100 guys in the airport at any given moment over the summer. He shovels in a bite of scrambled eggs and home fries, clicks out of his dating website, and goes downstairs to talk to the state police. Lola Budd has shocked every adult in her life by excelling at her job on the ticket desk at Highline Cruises. Lola's Aunt Kendra, who has been her legal guardian since her mother overdosed and her father went to jail, told Lola she was too young and too immature to handle such a job. Lola Budd has exhibited some uneven behavior both at home and at school, but she convinced her aunt that if she took on a job with a lot of responsibility, she would rise to the challenge. She wants to eventually attend the hospitality school at UMass, and she feels a summer job that involves a lot of interfacing with the public will give her an advantage. She has been at the job for 3 weeks now, and she absolutely loves it. Unlike school,
which she believes is a waste of time, this job makes her feel adult, relevant. She's doing something meaningful, facilitating travel between Nantucket and Hyannis, which is to say, between a summer fantasy land and the real world. Lola especially likes her job on frenetic days like today, the Saturday after the 4th of July, when the line is 117 people long. This boat, the 915, is sold out. Every boat today and all of the boats tomorrow are sold out. To get tickets for you, your wife, and your three kids back to America today, you basically had to make that your New Year's resolution and execute on January 2nd. The woman who works at the station next to Lola's, a 60-year-old Nantucket native named Mary Ellen Cahill, has a sign in front of her computer terminal that says, "Bad planning on your part does not constitute an emergency on my part." Although Lola agrees with this sentiment, she finds the most satisfying parts of the job are when she can be a hero, when she can arrange for a last-minute ticket to appear out of thin air, when she can fix a snafu. Mr. and Mrs. Deignan meant to book the last boat back on Friday, not Thursday. Even though the ticket Susan Deignan was showing clearly said Thursday, which was the day before. No problem. Lola would switch the Deignans to the Friday boat, free of charge. Lola loves calling a name off the waiting list and seeing joy and relief flood someone's face. This particular day, however, there will be no faces filled with relief, and Lola has nothing to offer but a manufactured expression of sympathy. "I'm sorry, sir. I don't have a boat ticket available until Monday at 4:05. You may want to check with the steamship authority. Their car ferries accommodate far more passengers." Today there will be people swearing in front of and at Lola. Today there will be people calling the High Line a Mickey Mouse operation and a dog and pony show. A dog and pony show? Lola thinks. What even is that? In job training, Lola was taught to accept all comments with calm reserve. The worst thing she can do is react with anger or indignation, thereby engaging the disgruntled customer. "I have a problem," a puffy-faced pregnant woman says. She's sweating, carrying a toddler, and she has another child, perhaps 5 years old, clinging to her leg. "I was holding my ferry tickets for two adults and two children, and I set them down for a second, and when I picked them back up, I had only one adult and two children, which means someone stole one of my ferry tickets." Lola nods. She has yet to be confronted with accusations of ticket theft, but if it was going to happen, she thinks, then it was going to happen today. On the other side of her counter is a mob of desperate people. "Have you checked with your husband?" Lola asks. "Is it possible he took his ticket without you realizing it?" "Of course I checked with my husband," the woman says. "He doesn't have it. I was in charge of the tickets, and he was in charge of handling the luggage, which really means sneaking in one final beer at the gazebo because he has a crush on the bartender. The one with the..." She gives Lola a good approximation of the eye-roll emoji. "You know how men can be." One of the things Lola has learned on this job is how men can be. Before, Lola knew only how boys could be. She has had a boyfriend for 9 months, 2 weeks, and 5 days. His name is Finn McAvoy, and Lola loves him like crazy. It's true love forever, etc., and she presumes they'll end up getting married. Finn lost both his parents in a sailing accident, and so he and Lola are both in the same situation, virtual orphans. But Lola would be lying if she said she hasn't been amazed by the power she seems to exert over certain men. She has been propositioned by some and blatantly ogled by others. It's common for a pale, chubby, balding, married dude to confront Lola and find himself tongue-tied. What had he meant to ask her? He can't recall. And that's how men can be. Lola feels bad for the pregnant woman. Aunt Kendra worries about Lola getting pregnant, but this job is effective birth control. But there is nothing she can do. "I'm sorry," Lola says. "I don't even have one extra seat on this boat. The next seat I do have available is on Monday at 4:05. "But I had the ticket," the woman shrieks. I paid for it! And someone stole it!
Unfortunately, we have no way to prove that, Lola says. You might have dropped it accidentally and someone else might have picked it up. You do have your hands full.
But my mother is sick, the woman says. She's in the hospital with shingles. We have to get off today. It's a medical emergency.
Lola remembers to breathe. It's astonishing the lies people will fabricate when they're desperate. Lola wants to quietly tell this woman that her best bet for getting off the island is to pretend she's going into labor. She will be taken to the mainland in a medical helicopter, and her husband can use the one remaining adult ferry ticket.
I'm sorry, Lola says, and I'll have to ask you to step aside so I can help the next customer.
The next customer swears she has a reservation under the name Eufredo, but Lola doesn't see it on her computer.
Could it be under a different name? She asks.
I have the reservation number somewhere, Ms. Eufredo says. She rummages through her purse. The phone rings. Lola looks down at her console. It's the emergency line, one that can't be ignored. Lola picks it up.
Hello, Highline Cruises. This is Lola Budd speaking. How may I help you?
There's a split-second pause, then a man's voice.
Lola Budd? Oh, that's right. I forgot you worked there. Lola, this is Chief Kapanash. May I talk to your supervisor, please?
Oh, hi, Chief, Lola says.
The chief is Finn's uncle and legal guardian. He is a very important person on Nantucket. He's the chief of police. Lola has the distinct impression that the chief doesn't like her, doesn't approve of her. He probably wishes Finn were dating someone like Meg Lyon, a three-sport athlete with good grades and squeaky clean behavior. But now the chief will witness Lola Budd in her new persona as a responsible, competent Highline Cruises employee.
My supervisor isn't here right now. It's just me, Mary Ellen, and Kalik, and we have a boat leaving in 8 minutes, so everyone is really busy. Gracie should be back soon, though. Would you like me to leave her a...
8 minutes? The chief says. Put Mary Ellen on the phone, please.
She's with a customer, Lola says.
Put her on the phone, Lola, the chief says. This is an emergency.
Marty Skazerba talks to Brenner, the state policeman on duty at the airport, and gets more details about the potential murder. The body they have is a 29-year-old New York City woman who came to Nantucket to be the maid of honor in her best friend's wedding. The news lands like a punch to Marty's gut, because his very own daughter, Laura Ray, is getting married in September, and her maid of honor, Adi Conover, is like a second daughter to Marty. Because Marty's wife, Nancy, is gone, Marty has been the one planning the wedding with Laura Ray. They hired Roger Pelton to help. Marty and Roger go way back, as Roger's daughter Heather and Laura Ray played softball together in high school. And out of curiosity plus some kind of hunch, Marty asks Brenner, the state policeman, if Roger Pelton was doing the wedding.
Roger Pelton? Brenner says. He's the one who called it in. But I'm pretty sure he's been cleared.
Cleared? Marty thinks. Of course Roger has been cleared. He certainly didn't murder anyone. Marty tells Brenner to call over to Blade, the private helicopter service, as well as the private plane hangar ASAP. There's no way a person of interest would escape Nantucket via a commercial flight. The TSA are too assiduous. They're bulldogs. They don't let peanut butter through, much less a person of interest. Brenner says he'll handle the private services, and Marty alerts the TSA and the policeman on duty inside security. Then he goes back upstairs to his desk to call Roger Pelton.
I heard about the body, Marty says. I'm so sorry, Roger.
Roger sounds choked up. I can't describe what it was like, pulling that poor girl out of the water. The bride was the one who found her floating, her best friend, her maid of honor. The bride was, well, she was hysterical, and she's such a sweet, sweet kid.
Her big day ended before it even began, and in complete tragedy.
Ah, geez, Roger, Marty says.
He eyes his breakfast, which has now grown cold. He pushes the plate away.
Who's this person of interest on the lam? This Shooter Uxley?
On the lam? Roger says.
Shooter?
The chief called a little while ago, Marty says. They're looking for someone named Shooter Uxley.
He's the best man, Roger says.
Real gregarious kid, strong handshake. He went out of the way to notice the details. He's in event planning himself, I guess. I have 20 weddings this month alone, and I can't remember anyone. But that guy I really liked.
Well, he's missing, Marty says. He was about to be questioned by the police, and he escaped through a bathroom window.
That doesn't look good, Roger says.
I guess you never know.
Ain't that the truth, Marty says. And then he says goodbye, hangs up, and gets back to the job. When Mary Ellen Cahill gets off the phone with the chief, she hands Lola a slip of paper that says, Shooter Uxley.
He's not in the computer, Mary Ellen says. So he would have been a walk-in. He's 6 feet tall, dark hair, wearing a blue blazer.
That narrows it down, Lola says.
My guess is he took the steamship, Mary Ellen says.
I hope he took the steamship.
We're too busy for a murder suspect today.
Lola looks at the name again. Shooter Uxley. She pulls out her phone, which is expressly forbidden on the job, and finds him instantly on Facebook. He's as handsome as Tom Brady. And then Lola figures it out.
Hold the boat! She shouts.
She tears out from behind the counter and goes charging out of the office and down the dock. George, the steward, is just about to fold up the gangplank.
Lola!
George winks at her. He has a crush on her, she knows, which will work to her advantage.
I need to get on that boat, she says. And as soon as I get on, I need you to find a policeman and send him right behind me.
Whoa, George says. You buggin'?
Trust me, Georgie. This is an urgent matter, a life and death matter. Let me on the boat, then find a policeman.
Seriously?
Seriously, Lola says.
She wants to go charging through the cabin, but she maintains her calm. The stolen ticket. The movie star handsome Shooter Uxley stole a ticket from the pregnant woman and went sauntering onto the boat. Lola scans the faces. She sees old people, sunburned people, men wearing Nantucket Reds. She sees yellow labs, crying babies, Boston Terriers, women who have had a lot of plastic surgery. She sees a kid in a Spider-Man costume. She sees a shirtless guy in a pair of American flag trunks, passed out and snoring. Lola Budd feels a hand on her arm. She turns to see a policeman standing with Fred Stiftel, one of the captains.
Young lady, the policeman says, what's going on?
Lola glances around the cabin. Her eye snags on a face in line at the bar. He has his sunglasses on, but she recognizes the set of his jaw and the dark, floppy forelock. Blue shirt, navy blazer.
There he is, Lola says to the policeman.
She keeps her voice normal and her eyes trained on the person of interest.
Shooter Uxley. He's right there.
The officer approaches Shooter Uxley, who drops his beer. In the ensuing commotion, he tries to run, but it's too crowded. There's nowhere to go, and the policeman easily pins Shooter's arms behind his back and cuffs him. He informs Shooter that he is a person of interest in an ongoing investigation and that he will be detained until the police release him from questioning. Everyone on the boat is watching. There's a low-level hum beneath a general hush.
It's just like on TV, Lola thinks.
In this case, the hero is her, Lola Budd. She can't wait to text Finn and tell him about it. The chief will have to like her now. Friday, July 6th, 2018, 8:30 p.m. Karen. Bruce brings her a cup filled with a pale, fizzy liquid garnished with two blackberries.
What is this? She asks. Not the punch. I don't think I can handle the punch.
Not the punch, Bruce says. It's a wine cooler, handcrafted by yours truly. More cooler than wine, but I tasted it and I think you'll approve.
Karen takes a sip and is transported back to her youth. Her husband is the most thoughtful man on earth. Thank you, baby, she says. He kisses her full on the lips, and even after so many years, something inside of Karen stirs.
Anything for you, he says, and I do mean anything.
At the table, Karen eats half a lobster tail. Each butter-drenched bite makes her moan with pleasure. Never in her life has anything tasted so divine. Bruce tries to cajole her into tasting his biscuit. He pulls it apart so she can see the fluffy layers, but she demurs. The lobster was enough, more than enough. Bruce chimes his spoon against his water glass as he holds it aloft. The tent grows quiet. Karen hopes this goes well. Bruce has had at least 3 cups of the punch. Bruce says,
"Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Bruce Otis, father of the bride."
His face radiates pride. He loves the title, and Karen has to admit, she does too. The last time either of them were people of distinction, she thinks, was when they were in high school. She swam the butterfly leg on the 400-meter relay team, and anyone who isn't impressed by that has never tried to swim 100 yards of butterfly, much less swim it fast. And Bruce, of course, won the state wrestling title. Karen gazes down at the table and closes her eyes to listen.
We would go to the post office to mail packages or check our box, and the line was always extra long on Saturdays. But you know what? I didn't care. I could wait an hour. I could wait all day. Because I was with Karen.
Karen embeds these words deep within herself. She has been loved in her life, deeply and truly loved. She has been known and understood. Is there anything more she is supposed to want? But following her gratitude is guilt. She hasn't told Bruce about the 3 pearlescent ovoid pills mixed in with her oxy. The pill is an unpronounceable compound that she bought illegally off the internet from a website she stumbled across when she Googled euthanasia. She emailed with a person named Dr. Tong, who used to be an anesthesiologist, licensed in the state of Utah, and now provides terminally ill patients with drugs for a price so that people like Karen can end their lives with dignity. The 3 pills cost $1,200, $1,100 of which Karen withdrew from her own personal checking account, money she had stashed away from working at the Crayola factory gift shop, her mad money, as her mother used to call it. The other $100 she stole from Bruce's wallet in $5 and $10 increments. She justifies the act because, unlike Bruce, she does not have a penchant for expensive clothes. She has never spent a frivolous dollar in her life, and she certainly isn't now. These pills will put her down instantly, saving both Bruce and Celeste the anguish, mess, and expense of her natural demise. If she told Bruce, he would understand, she thinks. In 32 years of marriage, they have always viewed the world the same way. But what if he doesn't understand? Euthanasia is a topic that taps into deeply personal views of dignity and fear, but mostly spirituality. Karen is afraid of pain, yes. She's afraid of the cancer eating her up from the inside. Bruce is afraid of being left alone, but he might also be afraid for her soul. She has no idea. They haven't been big church people, though they identify loosely as Catholic and celebrate all the holidays. They had Celeste baptized at St. James in Palmer Township, back when Karen's mother and Bruce's parents were still alive. But Karen hasn't set foot in St. James for years and years. Bruce has always seemed to be on the same page as Karen. She doesn't know what she believes in. She just tries to be a good person and hopes for the best. But what if Bruce secretly holds the tenets of the Catholic Church to be absolute and believes that suicide will automatically assign Karen to hell? Karen hasn't talked to Bruce about life after she's gone because he refuses to acknowledge the inevitable, which, she supposes, is better than him accepting it too readily. As the assembled guests raise their glasses to Celeste and Benji, Bruce gazes down on Karen with an expression so filled with tenderness, with love and awe, that Karen can barely meet his eyes. Her ardor matches his own, but she is a realist. Cancer has made her a realist. She has, for example, come to terms with the likelihood that Bruce will remarry. She wants him to. It won't be the same, she knows. He will always love her first, last, and best. The new wife will be younger. Not as young as Celeste, Karen hopes. And she will add a new vitality to Bruce's life. Maybe the new wife will have a job that provides money for traveling, real traveling. National parks, cruises, bicycle tours of Europe. Maybe Bruce will take up yoga or watercolor painting. Maybe he'll learn to speak Italian. Karen can imagine these possibilities without jealousy or anger. That's how she knows it's time for her to go. After dessert, she and Bruce dance to one song, Little Surfer Girl. Karen has always loved this song, even though she has never been anywhere near a surfboard. She heard her father sing it once in the car when she was a little girl, and that was all it took. Her father's happiness and his carefree falsetto had been contagious. Bruce knows about this memory, and so he croons it in Karen's ear. They are dancing, shuffling, really, among the other guests. No one is staring at them, she hopes, or taking photos, or marveling that a woman so sick can still dance. When the song is over, everyone claps. The band, it seems, is calling it a night. The evening is drawing to a close. Celeste appears out of nowhere.
Did you have fun, Betty?
So much fun, Karen says. But I'm exhausted. She feels Bruce's hand against her back. Even the light pressure is excruciating. The oxy is wearing off, leaving her nerve endings to glint like shattered glass. She needs one more oxy before she falls asleep.
We have a big day tomorrow, Bruce says.
Celeste says, Tag is really looking forward to having a drink with you in his study. A drink and a Cuban cigar. He's been talking about it all week.
He has? Bruce says. News to me.
I'll get Betty up to bed, Celeste says.
No, darling, Karen says. You go have fun. It's the night before your wedding. You should go out with your friends. Celeste gazes across the yard to where Benji and Shooter are filling up cups of beer at the keg. Shooter looks up, then jogs over. Karen is embarrassed at how handsome she finds him. He's as good-looking as the teen idols from her era. Leif Garrett, David Cassidy, Robbie Benson.
Mrs. Otis, he says, can I get you anything? I happen to know where the caterers stashed the extra lobster tails.
This makes Karen laugh, despite the knives starting to twist in her lower back. How darling of Shooter to remember that Karen likes lobster, even though the days when she might have enjoyed a midnight snack are gone.
We're going to bed, Karen says, but thank you. Please take my daughter out on the town. I need my beauty sleep, Celeste says.
You're beautiful enough as it is, Shooter says. You couldn't get any more beautiful.
Karen looks at Shooter and notes the expression on his face. Tenderness. Celeste inspires it in people, she supposes.
I couldn't agree more, Karen says.
The defense rests then, Bruce says.
He kisses Celeste's forehead, then nudges her gently toward Shooter.
Go have fun, darling.
But Mac, Tag wants...
Your father will go find Tag for a drink, Karen says. I'm perfectly capable of getting myself to bed. Shooter takes Celeste's arm, but she pulls away to give Karen one more hug and a kiss on each cheek. This is an echo of how Karen kissed Celeste goodnight when she was growing up. Does Celeste realize this? Yes, she must. Karen would like Celeste to come upstairs, tuck her in, read her something, even if it's just an article from the issue of Town and Country on the nightstand, and then lie with her until she falls asleep, just as Karen used to do with Celeste. But she will not be a burden. She will allow, indeed encourage, Celeste to pursue her new life. Bruce turns to Karen. Let me just walk you upstairs.
I'll be fine, Karen says. Go find Tag now so you can come up to me sooner. I'd prefer that.
Bruce kisses her on the lips. Okay. Just one drink, though. Karen takes her time on her way to her room upstairs. She wants to experience the house at her own pace. She wants to touch the fabrics, sit in the chairs to judge their comfort. She wants to smell the flower arrangements, read the titles of the books. She has never been in a house like this, one where every piece of furniture has been professionally chosen and arranged, where the clocks tick in unison and the paintings and photographs are lit to advantage. The other homes Karen has visited in her lifetime have all been variations of her own. Corner cabinets to display the wedding china, sectional sofas, afghans crocheted by maiden aunts. Karen wanders into the formal living room and stops immediately at a black grand piano. The top of the piano is down flat and it's covered with framed photographs. The frames themselves strike Karen initially. The majority look like real silver and others are burled wood. And then she looks at the photographs. All of them seem to have been taken on Nantucket over the years. In the one that Karen studies first, Benji and Thomas are teenagers. They're standing on the beach in front of this house with Tag and Greer behind them. Tag looks then like Benji does now, young and strong with a wide smile. Greer's expression is inscrutable behind her sunglasses. She wears white capri pants with red pom-poms dangling from the hems. That's a playful touch, Karen thinks. In her next life, she will own such pants. When she goes to pick up the next photo, she hears someone cough. Karen is so surprised she nearly throws the photograph over her shoulder. She turns to see a woman curled up in one of the curvy modern chairs, like an egg in a cup. The woman is so still that Karen would guess she's asleep, except that her eyes are wide open. She has been here all along, watching Karen.
I'm sorry, Karen says. You frightened me. I didn't see you.
The woman blinks. Who are you, then? She asks.
I'm Karen Otis, Karen says. Celeste's mother. The bride's mother.
The bride's mother, the woman says.
Yes, that's right.
I noticed you earlier. Your husband gave that lovely toast.
Thank you, Karen says.
She suddenly feels very weak. This woman has a British accent. She must be a friend of Tag and Greer's. Nearly everyone here is. Karen remembers her vow to shine.
And what's your name?
Featherly, the woman says. Featherly Dale. I live in London.
Very nice, Karen says.
She should excuse herself for bed, but she doesn't want to appear rude to this Featherly. Why do the British give their children last names for first names? Winston, Neville, and Greer. When Karen first heard Celeste say the name Greer, Karen had thought it was a man. And this practice is catching on in America, she's noticed. She used to shake her head in wonder at the children who would come through the Crayola factory gift shop. Little girls named Sloane, Sterling, Brearley. Boys named Milhouse, Dearborn, Acton. And what about Celeste's maid of honor, Merritt? Like the Parkway, Karen heard her say.
though Karen has no idea what that means. I just took a detour on my way to bed, but I should really excuse myself. It was nice to meet you, Featherly. I suppose I shall see you tomorrow.
Wait, Featherly says. Please, can you stay another couple of minutes? I'm too drunk to get back to my inn right now.
Would you like me to find Greer? Karen asks.
She's only asking to be polite. The mere prospect of hunting down Greer is exhausting.
No, Featherly says. Not Greer.
Something in her tone catches Karen's attention. Featherly lowers her bare feet to the ground and leans forward.
Can you keep a secret?
Karen nods involuntarily. She can keep a secret, yes. She is keeping a secret from her husband and her daughter. The secret of the 3 pearlescent ovoid pills. The secret of her intentions. And that is surely a bigger secret than whatever this Featherly wants to disclose.
Featherly says, I've been involved with a married man. But he broke things off with me in May, and I can't seem to recover.
Oh, dear, Karen says.
What she thinks is, serves you right. Karen cannot abide adulterers. She doesn't like to judge, but she can say with certainty that if any woman had pursued Bruce and managed to ensnare him in an affair, her life would have been destroyed. She and Bruce are lucky, she knows, in that they're both true blue. This isn't to say that Karen has never felt jealous. Bruce would sometimes talk about the housewives who came into his department looking to buy their husbands a suit, and Karen would wonder what the women looked like and if they flirted with Bruce more than he let on. There had been one period, right after Celeste left for college, when Bruce had come home from work singing unfamiliar country music songs and acting strangely distant, and Karen thought that maybe he'd met someone else. She finally asked him about it. He very bluntly said that he was just upset about Celeste being away. He was finding it more challenging than he expected. Karen admitted that she was taking it harder than she'd expected, too. And they ended up crying together and then making love in the kitchen, which was something that hadn't happened since Celeste was born.
I think the truth might interest you, Featherly says. Maybe, maybe not.
Karen can't stand to hear it.
Stop, she says. Please, just stop. Karen holds her hand aloft as though she can swat the words away. She backs out of the room. The words swarm her as she climbs the stairs.
I think the truth might interest you. I've been involved with a married man.
Karen badly needs an oxy and her bed.
Why, oh why, did that woman choose Karen to confess to?
How could Featherly's adulterous relationship possibly matter to Karen? She knows no one here. Featherly was clearly quite drunk, and drunk people, in Karen's experience, love nothing more than to confess. Featherly would have told anyone. It serves Karen right for snooping around. When Karen finally reaches the top of the stairs, she's disoriented. Is her room to the right or the left? She steadies herself with her cane and thinks, the right. When she turns right, it's the last door on the left. But at that instant, the door Karen thinks is hers opens, and Merritt, as in the parkway, steps out. Merritt is the same young woman Karen thought of as the Scarlet Letter when she'd first arrived, before she realized that it was Merritt, Celeste's maid of honor. Celeste adores Merritt, thinks she hung the moon. And while Karen is thrilled that Celeste has found a real friend, she can't help thinking Merritt is a little fast.
Fast.
Now Karen sounds like her own mother. Or even her grandmother. Who uses the word fast to describe a woman? No one. At least, not in the past 40 years. Karen is sure Merritt must be very nice, otherwise Celeste would not be so fond of her. Tonight, Merritt is wearing black.
I, Karen says.
Now she is really and truly confused. This house has more rooms than a hotel.
I think I've gotten turned around somehow.
I thought that was my room.
Oh, it is your room, Mrs. Otis,
Merritt says.
I was just looking for Celeste. You don't know where she is, do you?
Celeste? Karen says.
Why, she was outside when last I saw her. She's planning on going out with Benji.
Okay, Merritt says. She seems to be in a tremendous hurry. She sidles her way past Karen and heads down the stairs.
Thank you, Mrs. Otis. Good night.
Good night, Karen says. She stands in place, staring at the bedroom door. Looking for Celeste? In Bruce and Karen's room? What on earth for? Why not look for Celeste in Celeste's room, which is down the hall on the left? Clearly that Featherly woman has written her filthy graffiti on the walls of Karen's mind, because all she can think is that she's going to open the bedroom door and find Bruce inside, and then she will have to ask why Merritt and Bruce were in the bedroom alone together. Hadn't Merritt been flirting with Bruce earlier that day? Aren't you hot? Karen turns the knob and swings open the door. The room is dark and empty. Karen exhales. She props her cane against the nightstand and sits on the bed. She waits for her heart to stop racing. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 10:20 a.m. Initial questioning. Greer Garrison Winbury. Saturday, July 7th, 10:20 a.m. After Nick finishes writing notes from his interview with Abby, he pulls on a pair of latex gloves and enters the cottage where Merritt Monaco was staying. He has gotten in ahead of forensics, which is how he prefers it. "Tell me a story," he whispers. "What happened?" The cottage has been decorated with a feminine sensibility, in pastels and florals. It's probably meant to evoke an English garden, though to Nick it feels cloying and overwrought. It's like walking into a crab tree in Evelyn. The living area appears untouched. Nick doesn't see a thing out of place. He moves into the bedroom, where the air conditioning has been turned up so high, the room is like a meat locker. Nick has to admit it feels good, nearly delicious after the oppressive heat outside. The bed is made, and Merritt's suitcase is open on the luggage rack with her shoes underneath. Her bridesmaid dress, ivory silk with black embroidery, hangs alone in the closet. Nick enters the bathroom. Merritt's cosmetics are lined up on the lower glass shelf. She is clearly a fan of Bobby Brown, and her hairbrush and flat iron are on the upper glass shelf. Toothbrush in the cup. She was nice and neat, Nick thinks. A quick check of Merritt's cosmetic bag reveals eyeliners, mascaras, lipsticks, and powder, but nothing more. Nick thinks. He's looking for something, but what? He'll know it when he sees it. On the dresser, Nick finds an open clutch purse that contains a driver's license, a gold American Express card, $77 in cash, and an iPhone X. He studies the license. Merritt Allison Monaco, 116 Perry Street, New York, New York. She's a beautiful woman, and young. She just turned 29. It's such a shame. I'm going to do right by you, Nick says. Let's figure this out. He picks up the iPhone X and swipes across. To his enormous surprise, the phone opens. What? He didn't think there was a millennial alive who left her phone unsecured. He feels almost cheated. Does this woman have nothing to hide? He scrolls through her texts first. There is nothing new today, and yesterday there's one text from someone named Robbie wishing her a belated happy day of American independence. He hopes she's well. The day before that, Merritt sent a text to someone named Jada V, thanking her for the party. Attached is a photo of fireworks over the Statue of Liberty. The call log is ancient as well. By ancient, Nick means nothing within the past 24 hours.
Friday morning, there was a call placed to a 212 number, but when Nick calls that number from his own phone, he gets the switchboard for the Wildlife Conservation Society. Merritt had probably been checking in at work. The scant offerings on Merritt's phone lead Nick back to Abby's comment that Merritt might have set her sights on someone who was already at the wedding. She wouldn't have to call or text anyone if she could talk to him in person. Nick puts the clutch purse down where he found it and pokes around a little longer. A journal left lying around is too much to hope for, Nick knows. But what about a joint, a condom, a doodle on a scrap of paper with the name of the person she was involved with? She's too attractive for there not to have been someone. He finds nothing. The mother of the bride is still in her bedroom, and the bride herself still at the hospital. Nick finds Greer Garrison, mother of the groom, on her phone in the kitchen. She has obviously just told someone the awful news and is now accepting condolences.
Celeste is devastated, she says. I can't imagine her agony.
She pauses.
Well, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. We're all still in shock, and...
Here, Greer raises her eyes to Nick.
The police are trying to figure out what happened. I believe I'm the next to be interrogated, and so I really must hang up, I'm afraid. Love to Thibault.
Greer punches off her phone.
Can I help you?
She asks Nick. She looks fairly put together, considering the circumstances, Nick thinks. She's dressed in white pants and a beige tank. There is a gold cross on a thin gold chain around her neck. Her hair is sleek. She's wearing lipstick. Her expression is guarded. She knows her task is about to be interrupted, and she resents it.
Nick says, Miss Garrison, I'm Detective Nick Diamantopoulos with the Massachusetts State Police. I'll need you to put away your phone.
You're Greek?
She says, tilting her head. She's probably trying to reconcile the name with his black skin. He smiles.
My mother is Cape Verdean and my father is Greek. My paternal grandparents are from Thessaloniki.
I'm trying to write a novel set in Greece, she says. Problem is, I haven't been there in so long, I seem to have lost the flavor of the place.
As much as Nick would love to talk about the Aegean Sea, ouzo, and grilled octopus, he has work to do.
I need to ask you some questions, ma'am.
I don't think you understand my predicament here, detective, she says. This is my wedding.
Your wedding?
I planned it. I have people to call. All of the guests. People need to know what's happened.
I understand, Nick says. But to find out exactly what did happen, I require your cooperation. And that means your undivided attention.
You do realize I have a house full of people, Greer says. You do realize that Celeste's mother has terminal breast cancer, and that Celeste has been taken to the hospital? I'm waiting to hear from Benji about how she's doing.
I'll make this as fast as possible, Nick says. He tries to ignore the phone, although he would like to take it from her. Would you please come with me to the living room?
Greer stares at him with reproach.
How dare you order me around in my own house?
I'm very sorry about that, ma'am. Now please.
He walks down the hall and hopes she follows him. He hears her rustling behind him, so he stops at the entrance of the living room and lets her walk in first. He closes the door tightly behind them. Greer perches on the edge of the sofa, leaning forward as though she might spring to her feet and escape at any moment. Her phone is in her lap, buzzing away.
Can you please tell me what you remember after the rehearsal dinner ended?
Nick says.
Who went where?
The young people went out, Greer says. The old people stayed home. The exception was Abigail, my daughter-in-law. She's pregnant. She stayed home.
But both the bride and groom went out?
Who else?
Nick pulls out his notepad. Merritt?
Did she go out?
Do you know what I do for a living, detective? Greer asks. I write murder mysteries. As such, I am intimately familiar with procedure, so I appreciate that you have to ask these questions, but I can tell you exactly what happened to Merritt.
Can you?
Nick says.
Exactly?
Well, not exactly,
Greer says. But the gist is fairly obvious, is it not? The girl drank too much, or she took pills, and then she decided to go for a swim in her dress, and she drowned.
You'll agree, Nick says, that as viable as that explanation might be, it leaves some unanswered questions.
Such as?
I've interviewed one witness who says she's fairly certain that Merritt didn't go out. So if she stayed home, where and what was she drinking? Did anyone see her? Did anyone talk to her?
I just walked through the cottage where Ms. Monica was staying. There was no alcohol in the cottage, no bottles, no empties, nothing. And no pills, no prescription bottles. As a fiction writer, you must know that it's difficult, when one is drinking and popping pills, to get rid of all incriminating evidence. Also, Ms. Monaco had quite a nasty cut on her foot. How did that happen? When did that happen?
Don't look for drama where there is none, Greer says. There's a term for that in literature. It's called a red herring. The term was coined in the early 1800s by hunters who would throw a kipper down behind their trail to divert the wolves.
Nick almost smiles. He wants to dislike her, but there's something about her he admires. He has never met a published author before, and it's true. If she is a seasoned mystery writer, she might be able to help them.
That's good to know, he says.
Thank you.
I came across Merritt at the end of the rehearsal dinner, Greer says. She was hiding in the laundry room. She was crying.
Crying? Nick says.
He remembers that Abby also said Merritt had been crying, out in the rose garden.
Did she tell you what was wrong?
She did not, Greer says. And I didn't press. It wasn't my place. But I think it was clear she was feeling left out. Her best friend was getting married. Celeste was the center of attention, and Merritt was at the wedding alone. Maybe she was depressed. I have no idea. But I can say that she was very upset, which only solidifies the argument that she drank too much. Maybe took some pills and went for a swim. Maybe she drowned accidentally, or maybe it was intentional.
Suicide? Nick says.
Is that impossible? Greer asks. It's not something one likes to think about, of course. But
let's get back to you, Nick says. What did you do when the party ended? You and Mr. Winbury stayed home, is that right?
I don't see why what Tag and I did is relevant, Greer says.
You're a mystery writer, Nick says. So you're familiar with the term alibi?
Greer raises an eyebrow at him. Touché, she says. Yes. My husband and Mr. Otis, the bride's father, had a drink in Tag's study. And then they must have gone outside to smoke a cigar because when Tag came to bed, he smelled like smoke.
We found a cigar stubbed out on a table under the tent. One cigar. Would you guess that cigar belonged to your husband?
I would guess, Greer says, but I couldn't be sure.
What kind of cigars does your husband smoke, Miss Garrison?
He smokes Cuban cigars, Greer says, but more than one kind. Cohiba, Romeo y Julieta, Monte Cristo. I hardly see how the cigar is relevant to what happened to Miss Monaco.
We aren't sure it is relevant, Nick says. Right now, we're just trying to figure out who was where after the party broke up. It appears a handful of people were out under the tent smoking and drinking, and we're trying to identify who exactly was there. Did Mr. Winbury say where he'd been when he came to bed?
I didn't ask where he'd been because I knew where he'd been, here on the grounds.
What time did Mr. Winbury come to bed?
I have no earthly idea. I was asleep.
You were asleep, but you noticed that Mr. Winbury smelled like cigar smoke?
That's correct, Greer says. I woke up just enough to know Tag was coming to bed and that he smelled like cigar smoke, but not enough to bother checking the time.
And you didn't wake up again until the morning?
That's correct. I woke up on my own at 5:30.
And, Miss Garrison, what time did you retire? Did you go to bed right after the party was over?
No, I did not.
What did you do after the party, while Mr. Winbury and Mr. Otis were in the study?
I sat down at my computer. I was writing. I have a deadline looming.
I see. And where did you do this writing?
On my laptop, Greer says, in my sitting room.
And does that desk face a window?
Yes, it does.
Did you notice any activity out the window?
I did not.
Nick pauses. Is it likely she didn't see anything out the window?